Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Education Is podcast. As always, I'm Nicole.
You are Nicole.
Today I'm Nicole, yes. Here along with Alan. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And today our guest is Miss Laura Yost, an instructor here at Kirkwood Community College. Here to talk about many things, but have her here under the guise of talking about passion, interest, and maybe a little bit of motivation and education. So welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
So just a little bit of background. Tell us what you teach and how long you've been at Kirkwood.
I have been at Kirkwood full time for 7 years, and I taught as an adjunct for 3 before that. I have a split appointment, so I teach for both distance learning and social sciences. And my primary emphasis is the Understanding Cultures core. I teach Understanding Cultures Latin America, Modern China, Modern Japan, and I also teach 2 history courses, Holocaust and Genocide in Modern Memory and Literature, and Modern World Military History.
So we're talking about passion, and we're talking about the interest. And I guess the reason we asked you to kind of come join us to talk about this is maybe this is obvious to some and not obvious to others who don't know you, haven't seen you teach, but you're pretty passionate in the classroom. And I wonder if you could just start there. Start talking about what do you bring to the classroom? How do you prepare for that kind of level of enthusiasm?
I think in part, to be quite honest, a lot of it has to do with my family history when it comes to the idea of education and why I believe so strongly in teaching. My father arrived in the United States in 1962 from Bolivia, and he had been in Bolivia for a few years. He originally was born in Spain, but in order to teach at the University of Cochabamba, he had to become a Bolivian citizen. So technically, when he came to the United States, he was a Bolivian. But when he arrived, he knew no English whatsoever. And he had 2 items with him, a suitcase and his lovely guitar. And he taught himself English by watching television. He pursued his education at Iowa State and then eventually earned a PhD in sociology, in rural sociology at the time. And his passion for learning was just amazing. He knew multiple languages. He was always with a book. He was always very, very supportive of both me and my brother in our schooling, and honestly believed that education was a life-changing experience, because when he grew up, his initial goal was to be a goat farmer, a goat herder, and then he had the opportunity to go overseas to South America, and it really changed his life. So he was a teacher, my mother was a teacher, my grandmother was a teacher, so we sort of had this legacy, I guess, of teachers. But the one thing that my parents always instilled in us was the value of education and constantly learning. And I think that is what, you know, teaching is about. And not to be too, I guess, pie in the sky, but personally I've seen what education can do because it changed my father's life.
So in terms of mustering, well, I don't know, maybe it's, so I identify as an introverted person. When I do teach classes, I think I bring a fair amount of energy to the classroom, I think in part because students respond to it. And I always sort of think of it like I have to muster energy. I don't know, do you think of it that way, or is it not that way for you?
Well, you know, you're human. Some days you have to, like, you know, dig deep to find it. But to be honest, I just find what I get to teach just absolutely fascinating. My 2 favorite courses, if I can say that, are Latin America and Modern Japan. And again, because it's sort of this reflection on just, I suppose, just very dynamic subject material and things that I think students could relate to if they, you know, think about it maybe in a different way. And I just think that's very exciting, to be honest. Everything's constantly changing in Latin America, not necessarily always for the better, but it's content that really just isn't dead in the water. I mean, there's something new every day in the headlines, and I find the Latin American people to be exceptionally engaging. I've been very fortunate to have traveled pretty extensively in South America and Central America, and I know Spanish, so I think there's an additional connection there personally, and I like to bring that out because it's just such a fascinating world that students can learn about.
Do you find students are picking up on that? Do you get it back from them, some of that enthusiasm coming back to you?
Sometimes. I think it depends on the topic. When it comes to Latin America, I think because we do have a lot of personal stories that can be shared through the content and through some things I've experienced and people have shared with me, that you get maybe a higher degree of interest because they feel maybe they can relate to these individuals, not necessarily their particular stories, but the fact that we're talking about people and you humanize, I guess, the subject a little bit more. So I think in Latin America, it does elicit a little bit more of a response than maybe in some other courses. But yes, I think so. And to be honest, sometimes you do get the comments, it's nice to see that you're interested in what you're talking about. And that's not to say other faculty aren't disinterested. I think sometimes they simply interpret perhaps that I'm a little bit loud or that I laugh or something, that I'm more interested than other faculty, which I do not think is true. But it's nice sometimes at least that they pick up, in my instance, hey, you care about what you're teaching, because I really do, and that is a nice perk.
Sort of along your growth as a teacher, do you feel like you learned any skills about showing your passion? I mean, my sense is that your passion flows from your personal interest and just your personal self. But are there ways that you've kind of learned to indicate passion, or kind of has it just been a natural outgrowth of who you are?
I think when you're comfortable with the material, you can maybe be more of yourself, if that's a good way to phrase it. So I think over time, maybe it appears that I've become more interested in it, but I think it's just a degree of comfort. When you start a new course and you have all the different assessments, or you have to choose content in terms of what you need to present, it might come off a little bit stiff. I'm sure that when I first started on the KTS system, because of all the technology, and then as the instructor, you're responsible and you can manipulate all that, that was some of the confusion and being overwhelmed myself, it might have just appeared, oh, you're going through the routine or something like that. But I think when you become more comfortable with it and you sort of know where you want to go, and that I think takes time with everybody.
What about some of the, I wonder if you can talk about some of the tougher content type, some of the tougher topics that you cover in some of your classes are kind of tricky to negotiate and to really be passionate about. And how do you handle those ones for some of those classes?
That's very true, because you don't want the interest or enthusiasm to be interpreted negatively, and the best example I can give of that would be the war on drugs, because we discuss a lot of elements that I don't think the mainstream media addresses, which is particularly the context of Latin America, the poverty, the corruption, the fact that coca, which is the primary ingredient for cocaine, has a history of thousands of years that even predates the arrival of the Spanish, and how it's a plant that grows naturally in very difficult environments. Well, when we get to the end of that discussion, we look at what Latin America is doing to address the problem, and in certain cases, such as Mexico and in Colombia, they've actually legalized small quantities of heroin, marijuana, cigarettes, and a little bit of cocaine. So when you get to the end and you say, think about decriminalization, you don't want that to be interpreted, oh my gosh, you know, they're now arguing that they're in favor of cocaine, and you have to make that distinction, which is sort of difficult. But that's another very good point that you bring up, because when you look at modern Japan, really between 1876 and 1945, you see a conscious effort to put Japan on the map through imperialism. And that's a very negative consequence for a lot of Southeast Asia, to be honest. And you can't put a positive spin on that, because there's nothing positive about it. Comfort women and the use of chemical weapons and things, that's not rah-rah stuff. It's interesting, and I think the passion that I have when we talk about those elements is just because it's a fascinating story. I mean, and that's what history is, and I think that's really one of the things I try to get across, is it's not just names and dates and this, but history is a story, and if you can bring in something interesting or details to help give it a little bit more life, then maybe you can get some interest there. But you're exactly right. It's very difficult to navigate sometimes the fact that I'm excited about talking about this and then discussing some very serious issues, such as, for example, feminicidio, which is the killing of women, which is unfortunately an epidemic in northern Mexico and Guatemala. It's a tragedy. And you're right, you do have to kind of temper and understand, you know, you're dealing with a very serious subject, so it can't be sort of, you know, too exciting in that sense, even though it's very interesting.
It makes me think there's sort of this relationship between passion and enthusiasm. Like, you can be passionate about talking about, you know, horrible things happening in the world, because it's a serious issue and it warrants a lot of attention and it warrants serious study and thought and all of these fabulous things. But yeah, there's something about being enthusiastic that I think is maybe the line that we're kind of talking about. I've recently started studying the Civil War with Acceso Centennial, and never had sort of a big interest in any area of history before, but I am so into the Civil War right now. It's to the point I think it's kind of annoying people, but it's weird because I think people, like, I'm really enthusiastic about it in a lot of ways, but it's this terrible thing. I mean, every night before I go to bed, I'm reading about tens of thousands of people dying, and you're just kind of like, I'm so interested in it, I'm so passionate for it. And, you know, when I talk to my dad about it, he's like, it's not really something to be excited about, Nicole. It was a pretty terrible thing. And I'm like, it's not that I'm excited about people dying. It's like it helps me to understand America in kind of our modern context. So it's very cool the way that history is. For me, I'm a newly learning about history person, and I'm really enjoying that passion too.
That's a good point that you make. I think, unfortunately, because we're so overstimulated as a society now, that maybe you do feel you have to go in and just be, you know, on fire the whole time to attract attention. But you're correct. That if you don't have that, for whatever reason, that might not be part of your personality, you might not feel comfortable with it, that shouldn't automatically then be interpreted as, well, then you don't care what you're talking about. And I think that's also a problem as well, that when you come in and you know your material, you know your content, you're really passionate about it, but it might not be reflected with that degree of energy that others might have. I think, unfortunately, in this society, it might get interpreted as, oh, you just don't care. But that's not true. I mean, there are numerous ways exactly to demonstrate that you care about it through your knowledge or through your willingness to respond to questions. It doesn't always have to be like, hey, here I am. But I think that's, you know, just something everyone has to deal with in the classroom now.
Do you think the nature of teaching history is changing at all? I mean, I know, like you said, it's not really about dates. It's not really about memorizing people. But it really was, at least my perception of it, really was that when I was going through school and even to college. The few college history courses that I took was very much so know these dates and write essays kind of outlining those dates and those historical points. Do you think there's a general shift in the discipline?
I think I honestly believe, unfortunately, that that's the way history is taught probably through elementary school, junior high, and high school. And I can't speak to why that is, but I believe that's what it is. Just memorization, fill in the blank, what year, who was it? And that's a detriment to students, I think, when they have to come and take a history course as a requirement because they have that negative concept already. I'm just going to sit here, memorize the book, and then regurgitate. And I think people who understand what history really is about know that it's much deeper than that. Every battle has a story. Every person has a backstory. I think I was very fortunate because when I was in graduate school, my major professor just basically got up in front of class and he knew his stuff, but it was just stories and very lyrical and very flowing. And yes, we had to have those details, you know, when did World War I take place and when did the Americans go into battle for the first time along the Western Front, but there was something else about it that just gave it content and depth, and that's what I still remember today. So beyond sort of the influences of my parents and the passion for what education can do, I think that my major professor instilled in me that there's a passion in terms of presentation that can bring it to life. And so when it comes to the courses that I feel most comfortable in, we talk about these sort of personal stories like Latin America and modern Japan. I try to bring that in so it's not just the Japanese forced the Koreans to sign this treaty here. Well, what was it about? You know, what happened to some of the Koreans? Are there any stories that we can share or something to give it a little bit more depth? And I think it's very difficult, to be honest, to break away from that, because even if they only have one of my classes or one history course, that might not be enough to break them from the expectation that, you know, history is just boring.
As someone with a lot of interest and kind of visible passion for your work, do you ever find it challenging when you encounter students who don't seem to have passion or interest for much?
It's sad. You're like, you should love this. But, you know, we don't have majors in these things and stuff. Yeah, to be honest, it is. I'm sorry I keep coming back to Latin America, but that's the one that really is closest to me, and I feel closest to that content. And that sometimes is kind of a downer. I'm like, no, this is like the most interesting thing ever. And it's like, no, not really. You know, there's a coin. It's called the Quetzal. And the Quetzal is the national bird of Guatemala. And it's their, like, $1 equivalent. And when I was in Guatemala, I got one of these when I was exchanging some money. And on it, it has a bird. And under one of the bird's wings, it says paz, which means peace. And then if you look at the other details of the coin, it says it's to celebrate una paz firme y duradera, a very strong and long-lasting peace, and it commemorates the signing of the peace treaty, which ended the 36-year civil war. In one of the most comprehensive UN agreements ever, we see that that brought an end to a conflict between the Guatemalan government and then a collection of rebel groups that were being represented by one particular organization. And when I got this coin, I was really excited because Guatemalan government has a lot of problems, a lot of corruption, and we could talk about that forever. But I was looking at this and I thought, well, maybe this is some degree of change. Maybe I've been too critical. Maybe I'm not, you know, up with what's happening. Because here you have, I think, a very honest and I thought a very moving in some part tribute to, we're sorry that the army was used to slaughter people and we're trying to really turn a page. So I took this coin to my instructor and I showed it to her and I explained how I interpreted it. And she kind of poo-pooed all that and said, well, not really. And she said, that's not how Guatemalans look at the coin. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. Well, if you look at the way Paz is spelled, the P-A-Z, it's not TypeScript, it's handwritten in cursive. But if you turn the coin maybe 35 degrees, the Paz turns into Arzu, just the way it looks. So the P becomes kind of an A and everything. Arzu doesn't really mean anything, but it was the name of the president in office at the time who'd signed the peace accords. So according to what I was being told by my instructor, and I believed her because she'd actually lost some friends who were in the wrong place at the wrong time during the conflict. She said, when we look at this coin, what we see again is the same type of thing, the president there commemorating himself by putting his name in the coin. I start my class every semester with that, thinking this is just going to be, you know, the shot that just puts everybody in shock, and oh boy, they're just going to be, you know, listening to my every word after this. And so you just tell that story and they're like, well, maybe. Like, well, I tried, you know. So sometimes, and that would happen to any instructor, you have this really good example or this excellent story and you think this is going to get them, and you're like, here it is, and you just kind of wait and it's like crickets chirping. And maybe they think, wow, that is so moving, but usually it's like, well, lady, maybe you're just reading into it too much. And I have to express that too. I mean, I don't have any concrete evidence, but I didn't think the instructor that I was with, considering her background, would be there trying to pull my leg. So it could be debatable what is there, but yeah, that's one of those instances where you're like, oh, I got him, and then no.
But maybe you do get some. Maybe you do, yeah, reach some. And how do you know when you reach them? Do you see something happen in them when you reach them, or do you have a sense of who you're missing just by their eyes rolling in the back of their heads, or how do you know when you've reached somebody?
Yeah, that's hard. That really is hard. Because students usually don't come up to you and say, wow, that was amazing, or that story was moving. That's just not how it goes, I think, a lot of the time. But sometimes, to be honest, you'll maybe get some small physical reaction, which happens sometimes in Latin America, because with a lot of the unfortunate negatives that we talk about, some of the violence and things, their eyes are opened up, I think, a little bit because they're not familiar with that type of environment. So sometimes you physically get a reaction. For example, again, with the drug war, sometimes we show some pictures that aren't excessively graphic, but you need to talk about how serious it is. And sometimes you can see that. Other times I think it comes across through their writing. And to be honest, in terms of how I interpret, is it working? It's if they make the connections to be blunt. They're not going to write, wow, this is amazing. But when you put the information out there and you can see that they're processing it, that you can see they're putting together some of the connections, even if maybe you spelled it out for them, but they still, not necessarily regurgitating, but they are understanding how things went together, then I think, yeah, we've made it. It's not going to be they stand up and cheer or anything. Or they say, I'm really glad I learned this. But through the in-class writing, because we try to do that pretty consistently, I think that's how you can see that things are kind of clicking. And that, to me, is a success. Because in a lot of cases, they've been exposed to American history, but they haven't been exposed to the history of the world. And maybe even if they had a global history course, of course that has to be an introductory survey. But when you have them in Latin America or modern Japan or China, and they're putting the pieces together, like, how did World War II influence the rise of Mao? When you see them doing that, you're like, I think, you know, I got through. And that's pretty exciting.
Do you see breakthroughs in the library, Nicole, to give Laura a little break here? Do you see any? Do you see any of those breakthroughs in students when they come to the library to do research? Do you Do you see anybody with passion coming through your doors to talk, to geek, that you can geek out with, to use your words in library speak?
Yeah. I think for me, it's kind of the repeat visitor, and it's a bit of a shame because it's really, I'm technically the distance learning liaison librarian. I was a distance learning student in grad school. I'm a big fan of teaching yourself online, the internet, all that sort of thing, but what I actually see from students are the students who I get to know by name, because I don't get to know students by name, because I'm not in a traditional classroom with them. So when they come back again and again and again, and I can see they're really working, they're at a table every day, they're struggling, they actually come up and ask for help consistently, they often build the relationship with us as much as we're trying to build it with them. And for me, that's passion and interest. We have one woman named Mary, she's got 5 kids at home. Only place and time she can study are a couple hours that she's scheduled to be at the library. She wrote an awesome paper on Emily Dickinson that we talked together about for 2 hours, me asking her questions and her developing her thinking. She got an A. She brought a copy to me. I've stuck it in a file because I'm just so proud of her. I really didn't do anything beyond my traditional reference librarian role, but that's kind of the passion that I see. And I try very hard with students because as a librarian, I'm really blessed to get to be a generalist. I know a little bit about a whole lot of things, I think. That's what I tell myself, at least. And it's really nice to, when you're talking with a student who does have an interest, when you can at least cue them onto something else that they knew about, they get kind of excited that you're a resource person for them. And then they start to be like, oh, well, there's this thing, I do this, and it's just like, rah, rah. Like with the sports guys, I love Frank DeFord from NPR. He's sort of the old sports curmudgeon guy. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but we get a lot of sports guys in the library trying to figure out how to start this paper thing they've got due tomorrow, or sometimes a little more time than that. But when I can be like, oh, yeah, I really heard about that. There's this great guy who writes for Sports Illustrated. Then they really kind of open up and show me their passion. I feel like we live in a culture where it's not often, and maybe this is because I'm an introvert, I don't know, not often really acceptable to show a lot of passion, especially in the academy or mm-hmm. maybe when you're lecturing. There's like a time when it's okay to show it, but I'm really passionate about some things going on in IT here, and in an IT meeting, if I were to jump up and be like, yeah, all right, let's get the, I'm excited. Guys, this is going to make such a difference. Like, that just kind of wouldn't be acceptable. It's interesting, the culture of learning, and I myself don't feel like I've ever learned anything I haven't had an interest or a passion in. Whether I've been taught it by someone else or kind of investigated it on my own, I have to have passion and interest. Otherwise, I'm very seldom motivated by a grade or, I have to do this because. I mean, to me, it's like passion and interest. It's just got to be part of education. But it feels a lot to me like a lot of education is this drudgery of, you will march through these assignments, you will march through these tests, you will march through high school, you will march through college, you will be done. And I'm like, and then do we get our marching orders for our jobs? I don't know.
There's a mandate to, you have your required classes, your core classes that you're required to take, that kind of experience.
Yeah, is it that, like math, I've never been a huge fan of math. I need it. I use it. When I talk to Mona Parekh, who we've interviewed on this show, I get kind of excited about math because she's really very passionate about it. But I just was never allowed to become interested in it, I think because I was forced to take it. I had to take it. I had to take it in this order, and I had to take it with these people. And I don't know. It's a question I think about a lot. Is it the requiring and the forcing of young people to do things that they are not yet interested or ready for that does this? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And the whole Montessori school system is probably based on the idea that this forcing, this compelling young children anyway, is kind of an, I don't want to say antiquated, but not always the best for their minds and mm-hmm. hearts even.
Yeah, souls, spirits.
Souls and spirits, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of soul and spirit in learning. There really is.
Yeah, I see curiosity in my students, and I think that's always kind of a wake-up call, I think, for me as an instructor when I see it. And it's not always in my face, but I'll walk into my Chinese class even now, and I'll see that they'll be maybe searching on their phones for a Chinese video or looking for a particular word in Chinese that we haven't learned yet and asking about that. And so they're curious. They want to learn it more. They want to know that information. They don't necessarily want to put in the time it takes to actually remember all the information, but they want to know it and they want to experience it. And so that's where I see a lot of their passion.
So aside from history and your interest in Latin America, like, are there things about, so this podcast is really focused on education, teaching and learning broadly. Are there things that you are interested in learning about kind of within the education realm, like outside of your discipline? How do you, and maybe what I'm really asking, how do you improve as a teacher?
I really like learning foreign languages. That's more just for fun. I'm trying to teach myself Italian, and that's really fun. And then Romanian I want to learn next. I tried Mandarin Chinese and didn't work out too well. It's very, very challenging.
Yeah.
Alan was wonderful. It was the student that failed. That was me. I'm fascinated, and this I totally understand where people are like, no, there's no interest here, in comparative economic development. And I have been doing a lot of reading about that now in reference to microcredit and microfinance, but even just sort of general competitive theories about how different regions have developed, or in the case if they haven't, how they need to. Aside from like all the specifics of what I teach, I still think the most fascinating question of all is, how did some countries prosper and others not? That just fascinates me. And so I've been doing a lot of independent research. I don't want to say research, but I've been reading up on that because that's like the biggest question of all. And that really sort of unites everything that I teach. But you were asking, you know, how do you become a better teacher? And I think that good teachers are never satisfied with, oh, you know, I'm going to wash my hands of it. I know it all already. Because it's not possible. So just following up, and to be honest, in interest, because sometimes I think it's fun in class that if there's something I'm interested in, even though it might not be the traditional subject matter, that you could bring that in, and that might bring some people on board. So for the Latin America class, I looked at the Dominican Republic, because if you look at particularly minor league teams, the majority of all minor league players come from one place, and that place is the Dominican Republic. And if you look in the Dominican Republic, there's even one community where most of them come from. And so you have a country that is desperately poor, but one of the primary tracks for males, and this, of course, sadly won't apply to females, is you go to these baseball camps, and it really is sort of a factory system for kids as young as six to 12, and then they get deals and all of the, it's just fascinating. So I thought that was really interesting in all actuality, because we saw a movie called Sugar, and it was based on this idea of a Dominican coming to the United States, but it was shot in the Quad Cities, parts of it, at Woodman's.
Because he was a minor league player.
Yeah, okay. And it follows his story, but they shot it here in Iowa, so I watched the movie, and then I did some reading about it, and then we talked about it a little bit in class. But you just never can be happy with, well, that's it, I kind of know what I need to know. And so sometimes it can be reflected in your personal interest. For the Japan class, I'm more interested in the Imperial Japanese Navy than the Army, so just read about the Navy. So we read about, we don't want to talk about what the Navy did and how the Navy reacted to pressures after World War I to reduce its strength and everything, and that's kind of interesting. So just constantly maybe looking for things that I want to learn more about, but that maybe could relate to class and maybe get people in because it's out of the box. Something I have just ILL'd a couple of books for is, after Kristallnacht occurred in Germany, some of the Jews that voluntarily chose to leave went to the Dominican Republic. And so they had this community there of Jews who had left Germany in order to avoid the repercussions of the growing extremism of the Nazi regime. And that's just interesting. So that would apply to the Holocaust course I teach in Latin America. So you can make those connections. And that's kind of fun, too. How maybe the subject material connected. So there's always a way to find something. Perhaps it could be seen as interesting, or develop ways for the students to maybe more interestingly apply that information. That's one of the personal challenges I have in class, is when it comes to asking the students to demonstrate their learning, I love interesting assignments. And so that's where I think maybe, okay, if they get the material and they're just like, well, it's kind of boring, maybe if they can fashion it in a different way, that might engage them a little bit more and say, yeah, this is kind of interesting. So creative assessments, I think, would be something I'm struggling with to try and do, because I think it would be important and I think it'd be fun and engaging, but it's kind of hard to come up with some of those things sometimes.
Well, that kind of gets us back to the whole idea that how history has been taught, I think, is very much so a rote content, a specific memorization game, whereas the way you're presenting it, the way you're modeling it, is that there's still a lot left to discover, and there's a lot left to be curious about. And I think the same could be said for science and certainly for the arts. There's a lot left to discover in just about any discipline, really. And unfortunately, I think when some students are introduced to certain areas of study, they kind of assume that it's going to be, oh, I don't need to be figuring things out. It's all been figured out before. I just need to memorize it. So I don't need to be curious anymore, because the curious people have already done that work for me, and I just need to figure out what they did and what they said. But like you said, yeah, coming up with other interesting assessments could kind of get them to that level of curiosity that maybe they're missing.
And there's always, unfortunately, regardless of discipline, some, you know, strict guidelines, I guess, in some sense. You need to know the Civil War started in this year and ended in that year and who the president was. Of course there's that. But you're right, it's trying to get the students to accept that that has to be part of any learning. I mean, you have to memorize formulas, you have to memorize verb conjugations, but that you can go beyond that and really make a course dynamic. And I think that's exactly as you were saying, where you don't want to lose them when they come and they go, oh, history, here it comes, that they need to know, yeah, you're going to get some of that. You have to. I mean, it happens with anything. But there'll be more to it, you know, sort of the icing on the cake.
Right. There's always going to be the fundamentals that you have to go through in order to build on something. Mm-hmm. You can't just start from zero and just be curious about comparative economic theories, right?
As fascinating as that is.
Right. You're going to have to build up to it a little bit, I think.
So you have these great ideas. You have these great stories. You have things you want to teach students, but the actual doing of it, how you design your instruction, to me is sort of what's really fascinating to me, in part because I don't really ever design instruction other than one shot, an occasional 2, 3, 4, 5 session kind of trainings. So what are some of your favorite creative assessments that you do with students?
For the Understanding Cultures core, and in the past couple of years, what I've been trying to do is create assessments that apply to all the courses so that there's some similarity. It's called Culture Shock, and I like it because it's one of the first assignments I have them do, and it's all visually based. So I have a little checkerboard, and these are pictures I've taken because I love to take pictures. So, and I like trying to make things very visual because I respond to that. But it's maybe a 4x4 square board, and each square is just one image. And then the students have to, because they're just being thrown into this for the first time, decide or decipher what the image is. And then, once they go through that stage, explain why they think it's significant to the country in question. So, for example, with modern Japan, we'll see Maneki Neko, which is sort of the waving paw cat, which has to do with good luck and this sort of mythology around a cat that I believed helped a poor man. And they'll have a picture of tea. Well, here in this country, you know, we just drink it, but obviously in Japan it's very significant. They have very formal tea ceremonies that have been around for centuries. In addition, their tea is prepared differently. We have a picture, thanks to Alan, of the monument at Nanking with just the number 300,000. It'll be very difficult, I think, for students, but some of them know about the Rape of Nanking or the event known as that. And I really like that assignment because it's, again, very visual. It's the first thing, and it's sort of like putting all this stuff in the student's face and saying, now you decipher it, because some assignments need to be challenging in some way. But I like that because then they have to put the connections together. So I love that assignment, and I have that for the 3 cultures courses. And I think it's fun, and they can look at it, and they don't even necessarily have to have the same answer expectation that I have, but it makes them think. But again, differently than what is the significance of tea in Japan, or, you know, things like that, or how did Buddhism get here? They've got to kind of sort that out by saying, I think I've seen that Buddhist statue before, and they do a little bit of research, and there's a Hello Kitty, and the chef program, whose names escaped me, where they would compete, that show originated.
Iron Chef.
Yeah, Iron Chef. And there's a little picture of the Iron Chef program that I took when it was on television, and sumo wrestling, and that's just kind of fun. So that's one that I think
sort of a built-in curiosity to that kind of to that assignment. I mean, there's a mystery there that you kind of want as a student, that you want to kind of figure out something, and otherwise you just might not know.
Yeah. And I understand that, but just to have a good faith effort in trying to say, man, if that's a flower, what would that be? Or that might be corn. What is the significance of corn to Latin America? Like, sedentary civilizations. But yeah, there's kind of, and I like that because then the students have to kind of, you know, work their way through it.
Yeah,
and that's part of the academic journey.
I think it does. I think it really kind of does just automatically awaken that sense of curiosity in you, because there isn't necessarily a prescribed answer that seems obvious to anybody. Whereas if you asked it just, you know, what is the relationship of corn in Latin America, then all of a sudden I think, well, okay, the teacher wants me to say something about the economy and the rural nature of their agriculture. But when it's just a picture of corn, then I'm like free to kind of make up an answer.
Yeah. And as long as it's, you know, legitimate in some way, oh, in Mexico they can't afford corn anymore because it's being utilized to make biofuels or something. And that wasn't what I thought of, but if it's correct. But you're right, sometimes I like things that have looser parameters. And sometimes, you know, you got to do the opposite. But if you can create something where there is some creative thought going on in terms of how they present it, I like that.
I think real learning is really fun. I really do. I think it's just a really fun thing. And I'm just really sad that there's this perception of school as boring or learning as this onerous work drudgery sort of thing.
And it's hard. I mean, math isn't easy, but it's not supposed to be. And again, if we can go back to my father always said that it's the process of learning that's the fun part. I mean, you're exercising your brain. You're doing something different. You're thinking about something. And I do understand. I mean, I had to take science. I wasn't very good at chemistry and everything. And I think, unfortunately, part of that is as you mature, you get to that point where you appreciate, wow, look what I've learned or look what I've studied. And sometimes I think, unfortunately, that's lost on the younger generation. And I know not everything is enjoyable, but to be in a classroom and to know, wow, I'm being exposed to something I did not know before, that should be fun, at least on some level, although it might not be your passion. But the majority of the world doesn't get that opportunity at all. And to be here and to be safe and to be in a very well-structured and well-supported with infrastructure educational system. Now I sound like my dad, but that's exactly what he'd say. I mean, we have all these things. I mean, that's fun. You know, you're not a six-year-old selling chicle on the beaches of Acapulco, but you get to be here. And I wish maybe that could be something that you instill, you know, that it's the process of not necessarily improving yourself, but I mean, you're changing every time you learn something, just in some small way, whether or not you know it. And that gives you sort of that eventual independence. I mean, we're talking a lot now at our school about critical thinking. I mean, critical thinking is a form of independence. You can find information, you can interpret it. You're not constantly going to be dependent on someone telling you something. And I think that's what education does in the big picture. It frees you, you know?
That's a great note to end on. I just want to give high fives all around you guys. That was a really fun conversation. So as always, you can find our podcast online at www.educationis.us. And thanks, Laura.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, everyone. See you later.